Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning. Thank you for joining us. We are Three Women, Three Ways, the show that talks about current events and women's issues and economic issues and whatever else is topical. And we talk about it from our three different perspectives. My perspective is that, I guess, that of student. I was, and I've been involved in the field of domestic violence for about the last 10 years, and I decided to go back to school, and I got my master's degree with a focus in domestic violence, and now I am happy to say I am officially working on my dissertation for my PhD in psychology. So I kind of went the academic route. Deborah, you introduce yourself, please. You also went the academic route, didn't you?
I did, and I went the academic route. My tagline is, I lived it, I studied it, and I worked it. And so after living it for, you know, 20-plus years, I decided to learn about it by returning to college, and I was also at the same time working in the anti-violence against women's field. So I have a three-dimensional view on all things violence against women. That's what I say anyway. And I will toss it over to our other diva friend, Pinkley.
Well, good morning, lovely women. This is Pinkley, or Connie Sue. I am a survivor of domestic violence, and just because you leave a situation doesn't mean that the event does not impact the rest of your life. So I chose to become a volunteer and working in a local domestic violence sexual assault agency, and have been in the movement and working towards ending violence against women going on about 15 years. So I went back to school and got my BA in social justice in 2007, and it's just a pleasure to work with these two other lovely divas.
So, shucks.
So I'm excited to be here this morning to talk about a really interesting topic, men.
Yep.
What about men? What about men in this field?
Well, I think we should start with backing up a little bit, because yesterday was International Women's Day.
Yeah.
One of the ways that that was acknowledged was by a program called, or the launch of a program called Ring the Bell. And Deborah, you're going to be talking about that. But our main topic today is going to be talking about men involved in women's domestic violence, not necessarily as perpetrators, but as people who are trying to solve the issue and help out with that problem. So it should be a kind of an interesting show coming up, I think. I would like you to join us. Our phone number is 646-378-0430. We'd love to take your call, and if you have something that you'd like to contribute or you think is important that we're missing, please give us a call, 646-378-0430. Deborah, why don't you take us from International Women's Day to the launch of Ring the Bell?
Because as you said, that was, I think, a very interesting day to announce this campaign, which is to engage men in anti-violence work. And so the name of their campaign and their organization, actually, is Bell Bajau, and it's based out of India. And in 2006, they were funded and supported by Clinton Global Initiative, which is our former President Clinton's and his wife, his family, their foundation. And so since 2006, they've been trying to develop what is sometimes referred to by prevention organizations as bystander interventions, and then they went a step farther and named it Men Engaging. So they started in 2006. And the campaign, which consists of taking a pledge, it's called Ring the Bell Pledge, and you can go to their website, which is www.bell, B-E-L-L, B-A-J-A-O.org, and you can click on the link, and it's the Ring the Bell Pledge, and it's just a short one, so I'd like to read it. It's called, I believe that domestic violence should not happen, ever. but it does. And if it happens in my neighborhood, I believe I have the ability to interrupt it. I pledge that I will not turn away. I will become involved. I will ring the bell. And I just think the wording of that is simple and to the point and very eloquent. How do you feel about that pledge?
I love that pledge. I think we should all make that pledge. I think that what's mostly significant about this is that they're actually getting a lot of men to join in.
They are. They already have, since yesterday, they already have 3,000 people via Facebook and Twitter taking the pledge. And it's their goal to get 1 million men between yesterday, March 8th, 2013, to March 8th, 2014. And at this rate, they just might manage that.
Wow. That's really significant. Well, and that's what Patrick Stewart was talking about in this particular thing. He said that he grew up with domestic violence when he was 5 years old. He saw his mother being beaten. And so he's been very involved in anti-domestic violence issues for a long time. And he kicked off the campaign yesterday for domestic violence issues and Ring the Bell. So he talked a little bit about, you know, his background and his experience with domestic violence. And there were a lot of big power players there. But Patrick Stewart, of course, if you know, he was the captain on Star Trek, The Next Generation, which was wildly popular. And he said, and I think this is significant, violence against women is the single greatest human rights violation of our generation. Because it doesn't matter race, economic status, country, it happens to women everywhere. And so he stood up and made the call against it. And he said that he has 3 daughters and that he will continue the battle. Michael Bolton also was there, of course, the vocalist Michael Bolton, the musician, and he talked about lobbying for the extension of the Violence Against Women Act, passed just earlier this week, and he had said he had 3 daughters and he's going to keep fighting for this issue. And, there are a lot of big power players, a lot of men's role models were there. The Dallas Mayor Michael Rawlings said that, and I like this one, you can call a man who hits a woman a lot of things, but you can't call him a man. And Don McPherson, former NFL quarterback and Hall of Famer, said, we don't raise boys to be men. We raise them not to be women or gay men.
Yeah.
He's suggesting that we need to ramp it up in the way we raise and condition men and boys to actually tackle and disapprove of violence against women. So a lot of power players there. It sounds like they have a lot of spokespeople on the male side of things, and I think that's what
I think what's important there is, too, is it's not only a U.S. campaign, but it's international. And if you go to the website, you can see videos of men in different countries showing examples of how to interrupt. And they're really short. They're about a minute. And I think that's going to be really powerful for men across the world if they could see those PSAs or short intervention videos to think, oh, I don't have to go in there and beat the abuser up.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have to go in there and kill the abuser. No, that's not your role. Your role is to interrupt it and to let the abuser know that you know what's going on and that it's not a silent epidemic and it's not just happening behind closed doors, but you're impacting me and I'm part of the community and we all got to live together kind of thing. What do you think, Connie Sue?
I think that's a great segue into the bystander in the intervention. You did some research on that?
I did, and well, the three of us have been involved in the anti-violence against women work for a long time. And so one of the mantras we all have is that we need more money and funding and great campaigns for prevention. And bystander, intervention is a form of prevention. It's actually a philosophy and a strategy for prevention against various types of violence that include bullying, sexual assault, harassment, domestic violence, and on and on and on. But what makes bystander intervention different from other approaches in prevention work is, number one, it discourages victim blaming. It also offers the chance to change social norms, and you ladies know I'm all about that. We need to change our social and cultural norms. And the third one is it shifts responsibility to both men and women. It's not a women-only issue. It's a men and women. It's a boy and girl. It's a human issue. So I think that's pretty important. And the intervention, again, is you don't have to end it. You don't have to go in there guns blazing or risk your own personal safety, but the intent is to interrupt it when it's happening.
And the when it's happening is the key.
That is the key. And there's a little bit of theory behind it, and they say bystanders go through 5 stages before determining the course of action they want to take, which is to intervene or not to intervene. So the first step or stage is noticing. The second step is interpreting the event as requiring intervention. The third step is assuming responsibility. The fourth step is deciding what to do. And the fifth step is the confidence and capacity to take action.
I like that confidence, because I think it does take some confidence, doesn't it?
Yes, it does.
I think that's kind of key. And the more men get involved in this movement, the more they will develop confidence. I think the more we will all develop confidence on dealing with it. I think, you know, seeing or witnessing domestic violence or even hearing it. I remember being in an apartment once and it was going on the other side of the wall, and that was just terrifying to me. Understanding that this is something, there's something wrong here. Understanding that, I think, is just really key to being able to eliminate it and talk about it.
Yeah.
Pinkley, you did some research on an organization, didn't you?
Yeah, well, and I just want to continue the conversation just a little bit more on bystander. I think that the image that I would like to portray with this is that it doesn't always have to be about physical abuse.
Right.
You could be in a conversation engaging and what you think is just a socially acceptable, lovely conversation, and someone could potentially be making a sexist or racist joke.
Mm-hmm.
And you start going, wow, that doesn't feel good. And you might not have the answer, but you can just make the statement and interrupt and say, wow, you know, did you do or say dot, 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 or wow, what I heard you say, and interrupt. Interrupt is the key, and it doesn't always have to be about seeing somebody in a physical altercation.
Right.
It's about things that we're witnessing, things that we're hearing, conversations. So I think that the bystander intervention, I think that as an anti-violence movement, we have responsibilities in probably all aspects of our daily life to be on the alert for that. That's our responsibility.
Yeah.
And what we're
I agree with that.
And what we're asking other people to do is to be a part of that. You don't have to be a victim advocate or an expert, but you're just stopping and saying, wow, this is what I heard you say. Can we talk about that? Or, wow, did you realize that I'm interpreting that as being sexist or racist or homophobic or whatever that might be?
You know, I really agree with that, specifically from a survivor point of view. As I was living those 20-plus years in that abusive marriage, one of the thoughts that I'd had about that whole situation is no one ever told me the way he was treating me was wrong. Now, I know they all thought it, because after we divorced, I started hearing, oh, yeah, I thought this and that about the way he treated you, but nobody ever said that to me when I was actually in the relationship. So that reinforced it within me everything the abuser was telling me, which is it's my fault.
Yep.
So I internalized that totally, saying, well, it's because I'm not acting right, or I'm not doing this right, or I need to do this better. So I think the intervention at the time is so important. And again, I'm not blaming anybody in my circle. It's not their job, really, you know, to fix it for me. But what I would say, it would have been helpful for me to hear from someone outside my relationship say that was really a hurtful statement. And, or you know, I can't believe you're treating your wife that way. Or, you know, there's just some things you can say that would give the survivor themselves some encouragement to think that this is not acceptable behavior and it's not their fault.
Yeah.
But I think a lot of times people feel really helpless. They don't know what to say.
Exactly.
But if you frame it in a way that says bystander intervention, it's almost like here's permission to do that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
This is okay for you to do that, because I think that when you talk to people and they've heard or witnessed violence against women or domestic violence or sexual assault, they're really left thinking, number one, how does this impact me? You know, where's my love? I have to keep myself safe. But if you say, if you start talking more and more about bystander intervention, that gives people the permission to talk about it or to address it or even say, wow, I don't have all the answers for this, but what I just saw wasn't okay, or what I heard doesn't feel right.
And I like that bystander can go across the continuum of any type of violence. Like, how about when we're in the grocery store line and the parent is jerking the arm of the child in front of you, you know, or calling them vicious names because they're acting like children. you know, how many times have I bitten my tongue thinking I really want to say something?
Yeah.
I really want to point out to that person that they're acting like an ass, you know. But you bite your tongue and you don't say anything, you know. So this really works in all those kinds of cases. And it also gives the perpetrator the message that you notice what is going on and it's not okay.
Right.
I think one of the things that I have found successful in dealing with the grocery store scenario that you talked about, Deborah, is not confronting the person, because all that does is make them defensive and then you don't know what it's like, blah, blah, blah. But instead to be sympathetic and say, gee, it really is hard to be a parent, isn't it? That, you know, it's more difficult to find, you know, less hurtful ways to respond. And, you know, in other words, don't challenge. I think that that's an important thing, is that you don't just come right out and say, you know, hey, jerko, what do you think you're doing? Because that's not really going to do any good.
Right. I think that, but I don't say that.
Of course we all think that.
I think what a jerk, but I don't say that, because you're right. We don't want to challenge someone directly in those situations, but Joe, still we want to give them the message, right, that really what you're thinking about there is not a very good idea.
yeah, we see what you're doing and it's not acceptable.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of times, you know, when you look at the culturization of men in a lot of cultures, I mean almost every culture, it's they're supposed to, they're raised to be aggressive and handle things physically, and you know, I mean, it's how we raise our boys in many cases, and so, you know, what we're doing is we're sending such a duplicate message. We're saying, yeah, okay, you have to be rough, tough, and take charge, and you know, be physical, but then we come back and say, oh yeah, but you don't want to, you know, hurt people. Well, you know. Okay, but that's kind of a mixed message, isn't it?
Well, I think it can be, but, yeah, I mean, when I would answer the hotline and I would be talking with family or friends of a survivor and they'd say, I just want to go kill that person, and I'm like, well, you know, I understand you feel that way, but is that the best course of action? Is that going to resolve the situation?
or are you going to end up in jail? You know,
yeah.
You have to be able to mitigate that anger and de-escalate it down to reasonableness, right?
No.
It's a
well,
skill.
Well, I think that the acknowledgement is so important. I think back to my marriage, and for many years I just kept thinking, I'm not cut out for marriage. I assumed that this is what marriage was, that everybody's marriage was like this, and because I didn't like it, I just must be that odd duck that you know, isn't cut out for marriage. Because nobody acknowledged that it was an improper behavior.
Yeah, I so agree with that.
And isn't partly the key of domestic violence is isolation?
Yeah.
So that continues to support that behavior of isolation when someone doesn't say something or recognize.
Hey, Connie Sue, tell us about one of the groups you looked up.
Well, so before we do that, I want to hear more about the initial White Ribbon campaign. I mean, what you were saying is that they were the oldest group?
I was talking about Men Stopping Violence. In the United States, I think they might be the oldest men engagement organization, because they celebrated 30 years.
Huh? How many years?
30.
Wow.
Wow.
Yes, 30 years.
Yeah. Hey, before we get into that, Deborah, I think it's time for a little bit of break, and you're going to tell us about your other podcasting show that you do.
Oh, yeah, I'd love to. So this is a commercial. It's a commercial because my other work sponsors the work we do with Three Divas. Isn't that how it goes, ladies?
Sure.
So Self-Empowerment Strategies is it's my business, and I am a consultant. I'm a trainer. I'm a speaker. I'm a facilitator. I write, and I really do a lot of work on anti-violence against women. And I have a Blog Talk radio show. It's on Sunday evenings at 7 p.m. That's Pacific Standard Time. Now, you have to watch the time zones. And remember, this weekend we're springing forward, so we're changing our clocks. We're moving ahead an hour. But at any rate, Sunday evenings at 7 p.m. Pacific Time, I will be talking about self-empowerment strategies. And the purpose of this radio show is to remind everyone of their own sense of power, to regain your empowerment and to work through any issues you may have that are an impact of an experience of violence. And that experience of violence can be anything from domestic violence, trafficking, child abuse, to natural disasters such as the Superstorm Sandy or the Hurricane Katrina, which, you know, was a devastating, or a tsunami or flood or a tornado. So, and there's also the problem of secondary or vicarious trauma. These things impact us in our life. If we do not recognize them and try to work through them and live with them in a harmonious way, they impact our ability to make decisions and to feel like a whole person. So I encourage you to join me, and we're all about changing social and cultural norms on Self-Empowerment Strategies, Blog Talk Radio. So join me.
Great. Thank you. Now, Pinkley.
Hey, well, you know, it was interesting. There was a campaign that's been recently kind of going around about real men don't buy girls. I've been seeing a lot of postings on Facebook about that, so I thought it'd be interesting to see kind of where that came from. And this was actually started from the DNA, which is the Demi and Ashton Foundation, which, of course, if you're up to date on the Hollywood stars and the interactions going on there, you know that they're no longer together. But that's sort of beside the point. I just wanted to point that out. I'm very interested in doing more research after they stumbled across a Dateline feature on sex trafficking in Cambodia and was astounded by what he saw. But he also wanted to
research more how is this impacting the U.S. And at that time, the information that was gathered was between 100 and 300,000 girls alone in the U.S. are enslaved and sold for sex, while upwards of a million girls are prostituted worldwide, which generates, get this, approximately, and of course this is only what's reported, $39 billion annually. And the average age of a girl is 13. And the average man who buys a girl, is 30 years old and actually has no prior criminal record and has a well-paying job. So he started this campaign, Real Men Don't Buy Girls campaign, in hopes that people around the world will address these issues and move forward in the anti-violence field. So it's actually called the DNA Project. And so it's Real Men Don't Buy Girls. And I thought it was really interesting. And there was one other assignment.
So tell us what the campaign is, how they are utilizing it.
Like it's
pictures of celebrities, man celebrities, holding a sign. Just describe that a little bit for our listeners.
Well, they're just like what's popular right now on YouTube. You're holding up a sign. And basically it's saying they have different celebrities or different men holding up signs saying real men don't buy girls. So it's a pretty simplistic way of advertising, but I think the message is strong in saying that you don't need to buy girls. This is not okay. And I think all of us would agree with that. And I think even the men who are probably engaging in this activity would agree on the outside and not say, oh, yeah, this is what I participate in. As it says, it's these guys that are doing that really have no record. There's no real history other than they're doing it, and they have a well-paying job. And the thing is, they're doing it because they can.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's my opinion. No one's holding them accountable to it. They're doing it because they can.
Well, so we see men, moving toward that area as well to try and do something about it. What other areas do we have of men doing some actual, behavioral stuff to try and address these issues of violence and sex trading and all that other stuff? Deborah, didn't you look up another organization?
Absolutely did. I looked up Men Stopping Violence, and they are located in the United States, and actually office in Decatur, Georgia, which is the same thing as Atlanta, so it's very close to Atlanta. But they have a really interesting history, and I just want to point that out a little bit, is they started as a group that was providing batterers treatment for men who perpetrated violence, and then they evolved, shall we say, they evolved to working in social and social change and human rights, and so they expanded their vision. So they have always had a woman executive director, which I think was really, really interesting, that it's a men's organization, and they purposely decided to have a woman as their leader, which I think says a lot for them.
Mm-hmm.
That's a very innovative strategy. And their first director got cancer and died suddenly, so then that happened. And then we had Ulister Douglas and Dick Bathrick, who I think is one of the founders. So they decided to co-direct until they hired another woman, Shelley, in 2004. And then they just announced their most recent hire in the executive director position. And her name is, Isha Pandit. And she's been actually quite involved in on the social media, being interviewed and things like that. So I wanted to point out, too, if anybody recognizes the name John Lewis, he was actually one of their first director of their board of directors. John Lewis is a congressman from Georgia, and he was also in the civil rights movement, working with Martin Luther King and all those leaders of the civil rights movement in the late 60s. So there's a lot of history in men stopping rape. And I think what is really cool is their philosophy. So if you'd let me read that for a minute. It's called MSV, works locally, nationally, and internationally to dismantle belief systems, social structures, and institutional practices that oppress women and children and dehumanize men themselves. We look to the violence against women's movement to keep the reality of the problem and the vision of the solution before us. We believe that all forms of oppression are interconnected. Social justice work in the areas of race, class, gender, age, and sexual orientation are critical to ending violence against women. And right there, I fall in love with men stopping violence.
Yeah,
they had me at
yeah.
We look to the violence against women's movement.
Yeah.
They had me right there.
Well, I think one of the things that alludes to, which is what I was finding, is that there are a lot of smaller local movements that are dealing with violence against women that are men's groups. Right here in the Seattle area, we have the Mariners baseball team, and they are having their second annual Refuse to Abuse Day coming up this season. And what that is that the baseball players all get together and they dedicate a game, you know, to talking, you know, to eliminating violence against women. And a lot of those Mariners are out there speaking about it, and it all benefits the state coalition. So there's a, you know, that's the Refuse to Abuse movement. And then I also...
A lot of days with some of their, you know, more famous athletes on the Mariners team. And then the women... The wives of, or partners of the Mariners players have their own organization, and they do fundraising as well to support violence against women things around the area. So this, do you know how long that's been going on? Did you find a start date for that, Heather?
I didn't. I found the Refuse to Abuse thing is relatively new, but I didn't actually get information about the wives.
Actually, the Refuse to Abuse campaign has been around for a very long time.
Yeah.
Has it?
Yeah, but I think, I don't know, I would say probably 90s maybe, even a little bit.
90s when they started.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
And they, and then it just, for whatever reason, for a few years, it didn't have the same momentum. So I see that it has picked up back up over the last couple of years. So for some, it might be brand new, but it's been something that's been around for a long time.
And I think its purpose is not only to raise money. Its primary purpose is to raise awareness and the role that athletes play in our culture in the United States, right, how we look up to our athletes, and that there's an expectation that they will be role models for young boys and men who aspire to be like them.
Right.
Yeah.
Which I think is a good approach.
And what a captive audience you've got there, huh? Everybody's sitting down.
Yeah, exactly.
Nine innings.
Eating those tacos or whatever it is they serve there.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that Refuse to Abuse thing, I thought it had been around longer than that, but the research that I pulled up said that it was going to be their second annual. So I don't know how that you know, just goes to prove you can't believe everything you read on the internet, right? There also, one of the things that I found that I thought was interesting is that there is a publication called Voicemail, and it's out of Massachusetts, but it's an entire publication dedicated to men's involvement in stopping domestic violence and violence against women. To think that there's an entire publication for that. It comes out on a regular basis, and the editor is Rob Oken, O-K-E-U-N, and they just do all sorts of articles and print all sorts of information about men's involvement in stopping domestic violence. So if you can access them online, they have some really good articles that I was looking at, you know, historically in their archives. And, oh, wow, that's a good publication as well.
Wow, what a catchy name, Voicemail.
Yep, M-A-L-E, Voicemail.
Yeah, wow, I love that.
Yeah.
They've been around a while too, Heather, because you said you had some contact with them a while ago, and it was before you edited or, you know, published your anthology, right?
Yeah, and then when we came out with the anthology, they did a big story on it. I mean, he contacted me and asked me if they could feature that in their newsletter, which he did. So, you know, he's up on things too, you know, what's happening, and I just think it's amazing that there are so many men involved in this movement. Did you guys run across any other groups?
Well, I did just look up the White Ribbon Campaign, and that started in Canada, and it is moving to be more of an international organization as well. They started in 1991, so they are like 20 years old, right?
Yeah.
They've been around for a long time as well. And the thing I like a lot about these men's groups is they're looking at the impact on men of violence against women. In other words, that's something you've mentioned a lot, Heather, and we all talk about, is that men are connected to women. They have mothers, they have wives, they have daughters, they have cousins, they have aunts, they have friends. As sisters, so if the women in their life are impacted by something, then it impacts them as well, and it is their business, and it is their responsibility, and I really, really like that.
Yeah. Well, and I think we saw from, you know, some of the people involved in the Ring the Bell campaign when it was launched yesterday, you know, a lot of those men have either abuse that they've lived through in their growing up years. Or they have daughters, and they're worried about, you know, what's the safety issues for their own daughters.
Exactly.
So,
creating that empathy, but it shows men, because a lot of men say, it's not my issue. I'm not doing it.
Yeah.
I don't have to be involved in this because I'm not the one doing it. We understand that, and most men are not the ones perpetrating violence against women, but it's the good guys who have to hold the other guys accountable, right?
Exactly. Well, and the whole role modeling thing. You know, a few weeks ago we were talking about that case in Ohio, Steubenville, Ohio, where the prime jocks of the school allegedly raped a girl, kind of a gang rape situation, and just basically had their hands slapped for it. She was a 16-year-old girl, and they basically carted her from one place to another. And in the audio from that, there was one little voice in the back saying, what if this was your sister?
Yeah.
You know? So just having men be aware of it, they can also, I mean, in that case, the bad guys, you know, it basically ignored him. But still, it was a voice, and it was one of their own, saying, what if?
Yeah. So on the Belle Bajau website, I found a page that says, why should men care about domestic violence? And they've got six reasons, and let's just kind of look at those real quickly. It's because men can stop violence. I think that's a great way to look at it, because domestic violence is not a woman's issue.
No.
And because men work with survivors.
Mm-hmm.
And also,
yeah, they do.
They do, because men listen to men. In other words, men will hear it from another guy better than they'll hear it from us three.
Yeah.
Because violence costs, it's a huge socioeconomic cost, right? Cost,
yes,
in workplace productivity loss, billions of dollars for health care, housing, and social and legal services. So if we could end violence, then there would be a lot more money for their wars, right? And the last reason is because men know survivors, and that's what we're talking about, is that men should be prepared to respond with care, compassion, and understanding when it happens to someone in their life. So I thought those were pretty good reasons.
I think those are excellent reasons. And again, what you were saying, Deb, is that, you know, men listen to men. Little boys, I mean, that's what we've got to start with. And little boys listen to their role models.
Yeah, I have to tell you a story, because I had two daughters and two boys, but my oldest son was blonde hair and blue-eyed, and the rest of our family is brown hair and darker eyes. And when he was about five, I remember him asking me, "Mom, when is my hair going to turn black like Dad's?" I mean, they are so associated with their male figures around them.
Yeah, they really are.
Just, yeah, like them, you know. And so it's really important, I think, that we start with our younger boys. Don't you think so, Connie Sue? I know you have nephews that you are role modeling for, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And the girls.
And the girls, of course.
Yeah, not just the boys, but it's all inclusive. Sometimes people think I'm too serious about the issue, but it is a very serious issue, and it impacts everyone in our community, not just, you know, families, but everyone who's involved.
Yeah, and I think it's particularly important. Of course, this is my issue, but I'm always yelling about is that. It's not just broken bones and black eyes. So
right.
if we can get men to appreciate and understand what abuse really is, and that it doesn't necessarily mean physical violence. I mean, I've encountered men who say, "Oh, well, I would never hit a woman. I would never hit a woman," and then they berate their spouse or girlfriend as if she was some sort of, I don't know. They just use a lot of physical or a lot of verbal abuse toward the woman, but they don't see that as abuse.
Yeah, or emotional damage, yeah. So they justify,
yeah,
it by saying, "Well, I would never lay a hand on a woman," but you don't have,
uh-huh,
to, you know, it's a not just physical, it's the emotional and verbal that hurts just as much.
Oh, yeah, if not more.
And sometimes it's just a look, right? Sometimes you just get a look and you know what they're thinking.
Yep,
and it's
exactly
not positive, and it's not love,
mm-mm,
you know.
Heather, do you want to do a shout-out about your stuff that you've got going on?
Thank you, Connie Sue. Yeah, I would like to talk about it. I helped found an organization for survivors of domestic violence called Heal Everywhere, and you can access us on Facebook. And what we try to do is to help women after they've gotten through their domestic violence situation. Perhaps they've divorced and they're trying to get back into their lives and make what they can of their lives. And that's where we come in. And one of our programs is DV Doggy, where since as many as 85% of domestic violence survivors suffer from post-traumatic stress disorder, that's one of the reasons that the ADA says you can use a service dog if it can help you get your daily activities underway. Then you can qualify for a service dog. And so we help PTSD victims and acute anxiety, chronic depression, many of those symptoms follow a woman throughout her life after domestic violence situation. And so we help hook those up with and a puppy usually, and a service dog, and help them get training for their service dog for whatever task it is. And I always like to explain that one of the tasks that one of our service dogs does is we had a woman who had some cognitive brain damage from a domestic violence situation, and she was becoming more and more isolated because she could not find her car. If she parked in a large lot, she could not find her car. And so she would only park if she could find a spot near the door. And, of course, that severely limits a lot of her activity. And we were able to hook her up with a service dog and train it so that she can go into the mall and she can walk out a door and tell the dog to find the car, and the dog takes her right over to her car. So that just opened up her entire life again. So that's one of the things that we really focus on is DV Doggy. And, again, it's Heal Everywhere, and you can access us on Facebook.
That's amazing.
Now, let's get back to the men.
Connie Sue, did you have another group that you researched?
I did, and this is really quite interesting. And I find myself being shocked every day doing this work at just how horrific and mean and just abusive people can be. But for some reason, this really took me back, not in time or, but just in retrospect, that you just got to wonder how long has this been going on. And there was an organization, and it looks like they were started in 2008, and they have a website. And it's www.truckersagainsttrafficking.org. And in retrospect, I thought, wow, how many times every day are we out driving on the freeway when there are truckers going by, trucks, hauling our goods and our services and things that we just absolutely could not live without. And this doesn't mean that all truckers are bad. I have a brother who has recently changed careers and is driving truck. So this is not a shout out of, you know, against all people driving trucks. There's women who drive trucks. But what they're associating this with is that right in front of our very eyes, people are being trafficked. Using the modem of trucks. And people are, I mean, I'm just dumbfounded. I can't even find the words for this. But their mission is Truckers Against Trafficking exists to educate, equip, empower, and mobilize members of the trucking and travel plaza industry to combat domestic sex trafficking. So really what they're asking is other fellow persons, men and women, to be engaged and to be involved. So it's a very proactive awareness campaign that this is happening. And I just want to put a shout out for the, there is a phone number that people can call so that if you are ever a bystander and would like to offer intervention, or maybe you don't know what to do, or maybe you're concerned about someone. So there's the national hotline, 1-888-373-7888. And again, it talks about how human trafficking is the term for modern-day slavery.
Yeah.
So for our listeners, this is not something that's happening in another country. This is happening here, right in front of us. It has the same statistic. It's a $32 billion worldwide industry, and it's been reported in all 50 states, and the estimate is in the hundreds and thousands. So this website has been created to enable members of the trucking travel plaza industry and other travelers learn what you can do to stop this atrocity.
Connie Sue, I can remember when I first learned about this, it was years ago, back when I was in an abusive marriage, because the abuser's sister was married to a long-haul truck driver, and she would go along with him. She'd come back and say these stories. She'd go, you can't believe how many young girls are trying to hook up with truck drivers. They're just lot lizards. And I was like, what? What are you talking about? And she says, yeah, there's all these teeny boppers at all the truck stops trying to, you know, sell themselves to truck drivers and stuff like that. And I was like, really, that just didn't sound right to me, you know, that teenagers would be willingly hanging out at truck stops to, so that was the first time I was introduced to that, even as a, you know, as a fleeting idea many, many years ago. But since I've been learning more about trafficking, it fits into the whole scenario, because the trafficked people are often taken across state lines, which makes it much, much, much more difficult to find them, right? And half the time, they not even know where they're going.
Well, and I think what's most disturbing about this is that most, I would say, not all, but generally most of the girls that are being picked up and being held against their will and threatened and so on and so forth are probably people who have experienced some form of domestic violence or sexual assault in their home life, and they're trying to be safe. They've left looking for either a ride or a way out, and then find themselves completely entrapped in a system that they're now being trafficked. So they're it's a horrific system of abuse for these young girls and women that are caught up in this. But there is a movement within the truckers industry to stop this, and TACT, T-A-T, is the shortcut, and you can also put that. They have a free app that you can put on your phone, and there's also, like, they've developed little wallet-sized cards in different languages, and just, you know, you wonder when you stop at a rest stop. You know, I've actually seen where I've thought suspiciously something's not right here. I don't know if you guys have had that experience. I mean, I know that one of my escape routes when I left my home under domestic violence is that I would actually go leave the house and sleep in my cars for days on end at a rest stop. So I saw really suspicious looking things, but it would never have occurred to me at that time, because I was in my own paralysis, but that these kinds of activities were happening, and those were just at rest stops.
Yeah.
If you sort of truck stop, I mean, I don't know, and I don't want to put it, I don't want it to come across as I'm putting down the industry, because I think it's vitally important. We need those people out there that are risking their lives every day on the roads to bring us our goods that we consume as consumers. But the fact that it's a method of transporting women and young girls to be trafficked.
Yeah. You know, that fits in with the Real Men Don't Buy Girls campaign, kind of, because the majority of truck drivers are men. And so we're telling men, don't buy girls. You know, they should all be snapping pictures of themselves and posting it on
Yeah. Well, I think that
I don't buy girls, you know.
Yeah. It's significant, though, that, you know, it's a truckers group to stop that.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, so, yeah, it might be endemic in that particular field, but at least there's a group of truckers themselves who acknowledge that and recognize it. So I think that's pretty
We could
pretty
call that social change, don't you think?
I think we could. Well, I think that, you know, talking about those men's groups that are organizing and, you know, trying to really bring attention and education and stop violence in all forms against women, it just heartens me. It just makes me feel, because men are the perpetrators in the overwhelming majority of cases, I think sometimes, I don't know whether you guys feel this way or not, but sometimes I kind of just look at men and see them all as perpetrators when I'm feeling particularly frustrated. So this topic has really helped me to get back to that place where I know that, you know what, this is a social issue and society is against this.
Yeah, I think great too. And I'm also heartened by the fact that they've been around longer than we think. You know, with Men Stopping Violence, 30 years, the White Ribbon Campaign, 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, that is heartening, and it makes me feel good, too. We usually like to end with some kind of what can you do. And so if there are men out there or whoever's listening wants to share this with the men in their lives, there are some things that Belle Baggio recommends for men to start doing. And the first one is education, so they can educate themselves. Men can challenge each other. They definitely can support change. A political office, know who is running for office, work for funding, you know, all those kinds of things. Reach out to a family member if they think they're experiencing any form of violence. Another thing you can do is confront sexist, racist, homophobic, and other oppressive remarks. Another step is to be a role model, to recognize the power they have just by being male in our society and the impact they have on young boys. Reflect on their own behavior. They can listen and learn from the women in their lives. Do not fund sexism, by that we mean don't purchase girls, don't rent pornos, don't participate in prostitution, and protest sexism in the media. And the very last one is use inclusive, non-sexist language. So that's quite a list of things for all of us really to think about, but as we're encouraging men to join us in this work, I think that's a great place for them all to start, don't you?
I do too. I think that's great. I think that some of those would be hard for me to do.
Yeah.
It would require some effort, I think, on the part of a man who's committed to trying to improve the situation in the world. And I think that, you know, I applaud all of these groups. I just find it so interesting. I didn't realize there were so many men out there trying to make an impact and trying to make this a better world for women. So I really appreciated our talk today. And Pinkley, any final words from you about our topic?
Well, I think that, as you said, it's it makes my heart a little bit lighter today to know that there are organizations out there that are taking responsibility. I tell you, after 15 years of doing this work, you wonder, you know, where are the people supporting you? And we can't, the women's movement cannot do it by themselves. There has to be a society and a community, including men, all people who are involved in ending violence against women. And even if you're a bystander, that is a way to interrupt something that you might see or witness. So those are all very hopeful, tangible things that you can do.
Yeah. All of them are helpful.
I thoroughly agree with you.
So I would just like to say that, you know, I think that I'm going to become a little bit more aware of men's activities in this field because I really didn't appreciate them. And I think that as the mother of a son, it behooves us to be aware of what's out there. You know, what you were saying, Deborah, about little boys really looking up to other males is true. It surprised me. I always thought girls would be the more likely to do that, but it's actually, I think, the boys. Boys really, really believe in role modeling. So to know that there are some role models out there is kind of heartening. Deborah, do you have a quote for us?
I do, and I love this quote, and it's kind of a long one. It's from Eleanor Roosevelt. She actually said it in 1958, and I don't know if anybody out there has heard of Adlai Stevenson. I think he was Secretary of State after that. And he used the quote on his holiday card in 1963. But the quote is this: where After all, do universal human rights begin? In small places, close to home, so close and so small that they cannot be seen on any map of the world. Yet they are the world of the individual person, the neighborhood he lives in, the school or college he attends, the factory, farm, or office where he works. Such are places where every man, woman, and child seeks equal justice, equal opportunity, equal dignity without discrimination. Unless these rights have meaning there, they have no meaning anywhere. Without concerted citizen action to uphold them close to home, we shall look in vain for progress in the larger world. Okay. And I think that's just appropriate for today, is this all begins in the home, and it begins with each of us as an individual.
Okay. We're out of time. We're still on the air. Thank you for joining us, and join us again next week. We are three women.
Three ways.
Three divas. See you next Saturday on the air.
All right. Bye-bye.